Avery's stern guardian. Simon might not be as grim as Avery's brother Reed, but he still had that same stiff and dour look he'd had when Lyssa first met him. Avery seemed to get along with him fine, though.
"Okay," said Lyssa. "I'll see you later."
"You bet,"
said Avery, starting to turn.
"Oh, and Avery?"
Avery glanced at Lyssa.
"Yeah?"
"Adrian is available." Avery's only answer was a quick grin before she headed off to join Simon. Back with the Belikovs in Baia, the memorial service was going forward. Neighbors and friends, all Dampier, slowly arrived, many bringing food. It was my first glimpse of the Dampier community, though it still didn't seem as mysterious as Sydney had implied. The kitchen turned into a banquet hall, with every counter and table surface covered in dishes. Some were foods I knew, and there were lots of desserts, cookies and pastries covered in nuts and icing that smelled freshly baked. Some of the dishes I'd never seen before, and wasn't sure I wanted to ever again. There was a slimy bowl of cabbage in particular that I went out of my way to avoid. But before we ate, everyone went outside and gathered in a semicircle in the backyard. It was the only place that could accommodate so many people. A priest appeared just then, a human one. That surprised me a little. But I supposed when living in a human town, Dampiers would attend a human church. And to most humans, Dampiers looked just like them, so the priest no doubt thought he was making an ordinary house call. A handful of Maroi who had been in town were also present, but they, too, could more or less pass for humans. Pale ones, if they were discreet with the fangs. Humans didn't expect to see the supernatural, so their minds rarely considered it an option, even when it was right in front of them. Everyone grew silent. It was sunset now, with orange fire burning in the western sky and shadows falling across all of us. The priest performed a funeral service in Russian, chanting in a voice that sounded unearthly in the darkening yard. All the church services I'd ever attended were in English, but I could see how this had the same feel. Every so often, those gathered would cross themselves. I didn't know the cues, so I simply watched and waited, letting the priest's mournful voice fill my soul. My feelings for Dmitri churned within me like a growing storm, and I worked to keep them in, locked up in my heart. When the service finally finished, the eerie tension that had engulfed the group dispersed. People moved again, hugging the Belikovs and shaking hands with the priest. He left shortly thereafter. Food followed. Plates were loaded up and everyone sat wherever they could find space, be it inside the house or in the backyard. None of the guests really knew me, and Dmitri's family was far too busy to pay attention to me as they ran around and tried to make everyone feel welcome. Sydney stayed with me a lot of the time, and while conversation was light between us, I took comfort in her presence. We sat on the living room floor, leaning against the wall near the bookcase. She picked over her food, like always, which made me smile. There was something soothing about that familiar habit. When dinner was over, people continued chatting in small groups. I couldn't understand any of it, but I kept hearing his name mentioned. Dmitri, Dmitri. It reminded me of the incomprehensible hissing that the ghosts made during their visits. It was oppressive and smothering, the force of his name pressing on my heart. Dmitri, Dmitri. After a while, it grew to be too much. Sydney had stepped away for a bit, so I went outside to get some air. Some people had built a bonfire in the back and were sitting around it, still talking about Dmitri, so I headed off toward the front yard. I walked down the street, not intending to go far. The night was warm and clear, with the moon and stars burning brightly in the blackness above me. My feelings were tangled up, and now that I was away from the others, I allowed a bit of that pent-up emotion to burst forth, coming out as silent tears on my cheeks. When I was a couple of houses away, I sat down on the curb, resting and enjoying the stillness around me. My peace was short-lived, however. My sharp ears picked up the sound of voices coming from the Belikov house. Three figures appeared. One tall and slim was Maroi, and the others were Dampiers. I stared as they came to a stop in front of me. Not bothering with formalities, I remained where I was, looking up into the Maroi's dark eyes. I didn't recognize this group from the service, but I did recognize the Maroi from somewhere else.
I gave him a wry half-smile. Abe Mazur, I presume. Chapter 9. I thought you were a dream, I said. They all remained standing, the Dompiers fanning out around the Maroi in a sort of protective formation. Abe's was the strange face I'd seen while I'd been going in and out of consciousness after the fight by the barn. He was older than me, close to Elena's age. He had black hair and a goatee, and about as tan a complexion as Maroi ever had. If you've ever seen tan or dark-skinned people who are sick and grow pale, it's a lot like that. There was some pigment in his skin, but it was underscored by an intense pallor. Most astonishing of all was his clothing. He wore a long, dark coat that screamed money, paired with a cashmere crimson scarf. Below it, I could see a bit of gold, a chain to match the gold hoop earring he wore in one of his ears. My initial impression of that flamboyance would have been pirate or pimp. A moment later, I changed my mind. Something about him said he was the kind of guy who broke kneecaps to get his way.
Dream, eh? That,
the Maroi said with the very slightest hint of a smile,
is not something I hear very often. Well, no,
he reconsidered.
I do occasionally show up in people's nightmares.
He was neither American nor Russian. I couldn't identify the accent. Was he trying to impress me or intimidate me with his big, bad reputation? Sydney hadn't been afraid of him, exactly, but she'd certainly possessed a healthy amount of wariness. Well, I assume you already know who I am, I said. So the question now is, what are you doing here?
No, he said, the smile turning harder. The question is, what are you doing here?
I gestured back to the house, trying to play it cool. I'm going to a funeral.
That's not why you came to Russia.
I came to Russia to tell the Belikovs that Dmitri was dead, seeing as no one else bothered to. That was turning into a handy explanation for me being here, but as Abe studied me, a chill ran down my spine, kind of like when Yeva looked at me. Like that crazy old woman, he didn't believe me, and again I felt the dangerous edge to his otherwise jovial personality. Abe shook his head, and now the smile was gone altogether.
That's not the reason either. Don't lie to me, little girl.
I felt my hackles going up. And don't interrogate me, old man. Not unless you're ready to tell me why you and your sidekicks risked driving that road to pick up Sydney and me. Abe's Dompier stiffened at the words, old man. But to my surprise, he actually smiled again. Though the smile didn't reach his eyes.
Maybe I was just helping out.
Not from what I hear. You're the one who had the alchemist send Sydney with me here.
Oh,
he arched an eyebrow.
Did she tell you that? That was bad behavior on her part. Her superiors aren't going to like that. Not at all.
Oh, damn. I'd spoken without thinking. I didn't want Sydney to get in trouble. If Abe really was some kind of Maroi godfather type, what had she called him? Zmei? The snake? I didn't doubt he could talk to other alchemists to make her life even more miserable. I forced it out of her, I lied. I threatened her on the train. It wasn't hard. She's already scared to death of me.
I don't doubt she is. They're all scared of us, bound by centuries of tradition and hiding behind their crosses to protect them. Despite the gifts they get from their tattoos, in a lot of ways, they get the same traits as your Dompiers, just no reproductive issues.
He gazed up at the stars as he spoke, like some sort of philosopher musing on the mysteries of the universe. Somehow, that made me angrier. He was treating this like a joke, when clearly he had some agenda regarding me. I didn't like being part of anyone's plans, particularly when I didn't know what those plans were. Yeah, I'm sure we could talk about the alchemists and how you control them all night, I snapped. But I still want to know what you want with me.
Nothing, he said simply.
Nothing? You've gone to a lot of trouble to set me up with Sydney and follow me here for nothing. He looked back down from the sky, and there was a dangerous glint in his eyes.
You're of no interest to me. I have my own business to run. I come on behalf of others who are interested in you.
I stiffened, and at last, true fear ran through me. Shit, there was a manhunt out for me. But who? Lissa? Adrian? Tatiana? Again, that last one made me nervous. The others would seek me out because they cared. But Tatiana? Tatiana feared I'd run off with Adrian. Once more, I thought that if she wanted me found, it might be because she wanted to ensure I didn't come back. Abe struck me as the kind of person who can make people disappear. And what do the others want? Do they want me home? I asked, trying to appear unafraid. Did you think you could just come here and drag me back to the U.S.? That secretive smile of Abe's returned.
Do you think I could just drag you back?
Well, I scoffed again without thinking. You couldn't. Your guys here could. Well, maybe. I might be able to take them. Abe laughed out loud for the first time, a rich, deep sound filled with sincere amusement.
You live up to your brash reputation. Delightful.
Great. Abe probably had a whole file on me somewhere. He probably knew what I liked for breakfast.
I'll make a trade with you. Tell me why you're here, and I'll tell you why I'm here.
I already told you. In a flash, the laughter was gone. He took a step closer to where I sat, and I saw his guardians tense.
And I told you not to lie to me. You've got a reason for being here. I need to know what it is.
Rose, can you come in here?
Back toward the Belikov house, Victoria's clear voice rang out in the night. Glancing behind me, I saw her standing in the doorway. Suddenly, I wanted to get away from Abe. There was something lethal underneath that gaudy, jovial facade, and I didn't want to spend another minute with him. Leaping up, I began backing toward the house, half expecting his guardians to come kidnap me, despite his words. The two guys stayed where they were, but their eyes watched me carefully. Abe's quirky smile returned to his face.
Sorry I can't stay and chat, I said. That's all right, he said grandly. We'll find time later.
Not likely, I said. He laughed, and I hastily followed Victoria into the house, not feeling safe until I shut the door. I do not like that guy.
Abe? She asked. I thought he was your friend.
Hardly. He's some kind of mobster, right?
I suppose, she said like it was no big deal.
But he's the reason you're here.
Yeah, I know about him coming to get us. Victoria shook her head.
No, I mean here. I guess while you were in the car, you kept saying, Belikov, Belikov. Abe figured you knew us. That's why he took you to our house.
That was startling. I'd been dreaming of Dmitri, so of course I would have said his last name. But I'd had no idea that was how I'd ended up here. I'd figured it was because Elena had medical training. Then Victoria added the most astonishing thing of all.
When he realized we didn't know you, he was going to take you somewhere else. But Grandmother said we had to keep you. I guess she'd had some dream that you'd come to us.
What? Crazy creepy Yeva who hated me? Yeva dreamed about me? Victoria nodded.
It's this gift she has. Are you sure you don't know Abe? He's too big time to be here without a reason.
Elena hurried over to us before I could respond. She caught hold of my arm. We've been looking for you.
What took so long?
This question was directed to Victoria.
Abe was...
Elena shook her head.
Never mind. Come on. Everyone's waiting.
For what? I asked, letting her drag me through the house to the backyard.
I was supposed to tell you, explained Victoria, scurrying along. This is the part where everyone sits and remembers Dmitri by telling stories. Nobody's seen him in so long. We don't know what's happened to him recently, said Elena. We need you to tell us.
I flinched. Me? I balked at that, particularly when we emerged outside and I saw all those faces around the campfire. I didn't know any of them. How could I talk about Dmitri? How could I reveal what was closest to my heart? Everyone seemed to blur together, and I thought I might faint. For the moment, none of them noticed me. Carolina was speaking, her baby in her arms. Every so often she'd pause, and the others would laugh. Victoria sat down on a blanket-covered spot on the ground and pulled me down beside her. Sydney joined us a little while later. "What's she saying?" I whispered. Victoria listened to her sister for a few moments and then leaned closer to me.
"She's talking about when Dmitri was very young, how he used to always beg her and her friends to let him play with them. He was about 6, and they were 8, and didn't want him around."
Victoria paused again to take in the next part of the story.
"Finally, Carolina told him he could if he agreed to be married off to their dolls. So Carolina and her friends dressed him and the dolls up over and over and kept having weddings. Dmitri was married at least 10 times.
I couldn't help but laugh as I tried to picture tough, sexy Dmitri letting his big sister dress him up. He probably would have treated his wedding ceremony with a doll as seriously and stoically as he did his guardian duties. Other people spoke, and I tried to keep up with the translations. All the stories were about Dmitri's kindness and strength of character. Even when not out battling the undead, Dmitri had always been there to help those who needed it. Almost everyone could recall some time that Dmitri had stepped up to help others, going out of his way to do what was right, even in situations that could put him at risk. That was no surprise to me. Dmitri always did the right thing. And it was that attitude that had made me love him so much. I had a similar nature. I too rushed in when others needed me, sometimes when I shouldn't have. Others called me crazy for it, but Dmitri had understood. He'd always understood me, and part of what we'd worked on was how to temper that impulsive need to run into danger with reason and calculation. I had a feeling no one else in this world would ever understand me like he did. I didn't notice how strongly the tears were running down my cheeks until I saw everyone looking at me. At first, I thought they considered me crazy for crying, but then I realized someone had asked me a question.
"They want you to talk about Dmitri's last days," Victoria said. "Tell us something. What he did? What he was like?"
I used my sleeve to clean my face and looked away, focusing on the bonfire. I'd spoken in front of others before without hesitation, but this was different. I can't. I told Victoria, my voice strained and soft. "I can't talk about him." She squeezed my hand.
"Please, they need to hear about him. They need to know. Just tell us anything. What was he like?"
He was your brother. You know." "Yes," she said gently.
"But we want to know what you think he was like."
My eyes were still on the fire, watching the way the flames danced and shifted from orange to blue.
He was the best man I've ever met."
I stopped to gather myself, and Victoria used the opportunity to translate my words into Russian.
"And he was one of the best guardians. I mean, he was young compared to a lot of them, but everyone knew who he was. They all knew his reputation, and lots of people relied on him for advice. They called him a god, and whenever there was a fight or danger, he was always the first one to put himself out there. He never flinched. And a couple of months ago, when our school was attacked..." I choked up here a bit. The Belikovs had said they knew of the attack, that everyone knew about it, and from the faces here, it was true. I didn't need to elaborate on that night, on the horrors I'd seen. "That night," I continued, "Dmitri rushed out to face the Strigoi. He and I were together when we realized they were attacking. I wanted to stay and help him, but he wouldn't let me. He just told me to go, to run off and alert others, and he stayed behind, not knowing how many Strigoi he'd have to take on while I went for help. I still don't know how many he fought, but there were a bunch, and he took them all down alone." I dared to look up at the faces around me. Everyone was so quiet and still that I wondered if they were breathing. "It was so hard," I told them. Without realizing it, my voice had dropped to a whisper. I had to repeat myself more loudly. "It was so hard. I didn't want to leave him. but I knew I had to. He taught me so much, but one of the biggest things was that we have to protect others. It was my duty to warn everyone else, even though I just wanted to stay with him. The whole time, my heart kept saying, turn around, go to him. But I knew what I had to do. And I also knew part of him was trying to keep me safe. And if the roles had been reversed, well, I would have made him run too. I sighed, surprised I'd revealed so much of my heart. I switched back to business. Even when the other guardians joined him, Dimitri never backed down. He took down more Strigoi than almost anyone. Christian and I had actually killed the most. He was amazing. I told them the rest of the story that I'd told the Belikovs, only I actually forced a little detail this time, telling them vividly just how brave and fierce he had been. The words hurt me as I spoke, and yet it was almost a relief to get them out. I'd kept the memories of that night too close to me, but eventually I had to tell them about the cave. And that was the worst. We'd trapped the escaping Strigoi in a cave. It had two entrances, and we came at them from both sides. Some of our people got trapped, though, and there were more Strigoi than we'd expected. We lost people. But we would have lost a lot more if Dimitri hadn't been there. He wouldn't leave until everyone was out. He didn't care about the risk to himself. He only knew he had to save others. I'd seen it in his eyes. That determination. Our plan had finally been to retreat as soon as we were all out, but I'd had the feeling he would have stayed and killed every Strigoi he could find. But he'd followed orders, too, finally beginning his retreat when the others were safe. And in those last moments, just before the Strigoi had bitten him, Dimitri had met my eyes with a look so full of love that it was like that whole cave filled with light. His expression had said what we'd talked about earlier. We can be together, Rose, soon. We're almost there. And nothing will ever keep us apart again. I didn't mention that part, though. When I finished the rest of the tale, the faces of those gathered were grim but filled with awe and respect. Near the back of the crowd, I noticed Abe and his guardians listening as well. His expression was unreadable. Hard, but not angry or scary. Small cups began circulating through the group, and someone handed me one. A Dampier I didn't know, one of the few men present, stood up and raised his cup in the air. He spoke loudly and reverently, and I heard Dimitri's name mentioned several times. When he finished, he drank from the cup. Everyone else did too, so I followed suit, and nearly choked to death. It was like fire in liquid form. It took every ounce of strength I had to swallow it and not spray it on those around me.
What is this?
I asked, coughing. Victoria grinned. Vodka. I peered at the glass.
No, it isn't. I've had vodka before.
Not Russian vodka?
Apparently not. I forced the rest of the cup down out of respect to Dimitri, even though I had a feeling that if he were here, he'd be shaking his head at me. I thought I was done being in the spotlight after my story, but apparently not. Everyone kept asking me questions. They wanted to know more about Dimitri, more about what his life had been like recently. They also wanted to know about me and Dimitri as a couple. They all seemed to have figured out that Dimitri and I had been in love, and they were okay with it. I was asked about how we'd met, how long we'd been together. And the whole time, people kept refilling my cup. Determined not to look like an idiot again, I kept drinking until I could finally take the vodka down without coughing or spitting. The more I drank, the louder and more animated my stories became. My limbs started to tingle, and part of me knew this was all probably a bad idea. Okay, all of me knew it. Finally, people began to clear out. I had no idea what time it was, but I think it was the middle of the night. Maybe later. I stood as well, finding it much harder to do than I'd expected. The world wobbled, and my stomach wasn't very happy with me. Someone caught a hold of my arm and steadied me.
Easy, said Sydney. Don't push it.
Slowly, carefully, she led me toward the house.
God, I moaned. Do they use that stuff as rocket fuel?
No one made you keep drinking it.
Hey, don't get preachy. Besides, I had to be polite.
Sure, she said. We made it inside and then had the impossible task of getting up the stairs to the room Elena had given me. Each step was agony.
They all knew about me and Dimitri, I said, wondering if I'd be saying any of this sober. But I never told them we were together.
You didn't have to. It's written all over your face.
They acted like I was his widow or something.
You might as well be. We reached my room, and she helped me sit down on the bed. Not a lot of people get married around here. If you're with someone long enough, they figure it's almost the same.
I sighed and stared off without any particular focus. I miss him so much.
I'm sorry, she said. Will it ever get better?
The question seemed to catch her by surprise.
I don't know.
Have you ever been in love?
She shook her head. No. I wasn't sure if that made her lucky or not. I wasn't sure if all the bright days I'd had with Dimitri were worth the hurt I felt now. A moment later, I knew the truth.
Of course they were.
Huh? Asked Sydney. I realized I'd spoken my thoughts out loud.
Nothing, just talking to myself. I should get some sleep.
Do you need anything else? Are you going to be sick?
I assessed my queasy stomach.
No, but thanks.
Okay.
And in her typically brusque way, she left, turning off the lights and shutting the door. I would have thought I'd pass out right away. Honestly, I wanted to. My heart had been opened up to too much of Dimitri tonight, and I wanted that pain to go away. I wanted blackness and oblivion. Instead, maybe because I was a glutton for punishment, my heart decided to finish the job and rip itself completely open. I went to visit Lissa. Chapter 10. Everyone had hit it off so well at lunch with Avery that the group had gotten together again that evening and had kind of a wild time. Lissa was thinking about that as she sat in her first period English class the next morning. They'd stayed up late last night, sneaking out past curfew. The memory brought a smile to Lissa's face, even as she stifled a yawn. I couldn't help but feel a tiny bit of jealousy. I knew Avery was responsible for Lissa's happiness, and that bothered me on a petty level. Yet, Avery's new friendship was also making me feel less guilty about leaving Lissa. Lissa yawned again. It was hard to concentrate on the scarlet letter while fighting a slight hangover. Avery seemed to have a never-ending supply of liquor. Adrian had taken to this right away, but Lissa had been a little more hesitant. She'd abandoned her partying days a long time ago, but she'd finally succumbed last night and drunk more glasses of wine than she really should have. It wasn't unlike my situation with the vodka. Ironically enough, both of us overindulging, despite being miles and miles apart. Suddenly, a high-pitched wail pierced the air. Lissa's head shot up, along with everyone else's in the class. In a corner of the room, a small fire alarm flashed and shrieked its warning. Naturally, some students started cheering while some pretended to be scared. The rest just looked surprised and waited. Lissa's instructor also looked a little caught off guard, and after a quick examination, Lissa decided this wasn't a planned alarm. Teachers usually had a heads up when there were drills, and Ms. Malloy didn't wear the usual weary expression teachers had when trying to figure out how much time the drill would cut from their lessons.
"Up and at 'em," said Ms. Malloy in annoyance, grabbing a clipboard. "You know where to go."
Fire drill procedure was pretty standard. Lissa followed the others and fell in step with Christian. "Did you set this up?" she teased.
"Nope. Wish I had, though. This class is killing me."
"You? I have the worst headache ever." He gave her a knowing grin.
"Let that be a lesson to you, little Miss Lush."
She made a face in return and gave him a light punch. They reached their class's meeting spot out on the quad and joined in the semblance of a line the others were trying to form. Ms. Malloy arrived and checked everyone off on her clipboard, satisfied no one had been left behind.
"I don't think this was planned," said Lissa.
Agreed, said Christian. Which means even if there's no fire, it might take a while.
Well then, no use waiting around, huh? Christian and Lissa turned around in surprise at the voice behind them and saw Avery. She wore a purple sweater dress and black heels that seemed totally out of place on the wet grass.
What are you doing here? Asked Lissa. Figured you'd be in your room.
Whatever, it's so boring there. I had to come liberate you guys.
You did this?
Asked Christian, slightly impressed. Avery shrugged.
I told you, I was bored. Now come on while it's still chaotic.
Christian and Lissa exchanged glances. Well, said Lissa slowly. I suppose they did already take attendance.
Hurry, said Avery.
Her excitement was contagious, and feeling bold, Lissa hurried after her, Christian in tow. With all the milling students, no one noticed them cutting across the campus until they reached the outside of guest housing. Simon stood leaning against the door, and Lissa stiffened. They were busted.
Everything set? Avery asked him.
Simon, definitely the strong and silent type, gave a swift nod as his only answer before straightening up. He stuffed his hands into his coat pockets and walked off. Lissa stared in amazement.
He just let us go? And is he in on it?
Simon wasn't on campus as a teacher, but still, that didn't necessarily mean he'd let students skip out on class because of a faked fire drill. Avery grinned mischievously, watching him go.
We've been together for a while. He's got better things to do than babysit us.
She led them inside, but instead of going to her room, they cut off to a different section of the building and went somewhere I knew well. Adrian's room. Avery beat on the door.
Hey, Ivashkov, open up!
Lissa slapped a hand over her mouth to smother her giggles.
So much for stealth. Everyone's going to hear you. I need him to hear me, Avery argued.
She kept pounding on the door and yelling, and finally, Adrian answered. His hair stuck up at odd angles, and he had dark circles under his eyes. He'd drunk twice as much as Lissa last night.
What?
He blinked.
Shouldn't you guys be in class? Oh, God, I didn't sleep that much, did I?
Let us in, said Avery, pushing past. We've got refugees from a fire here.
She flounced onto his couch, making herself at home while he continued staring. Lissa and Christian joined her.
Avery sprang the fire alarm, explained Lissa.
Nice work, said Adrian, collapsing into a fluffy chair. But why do you have to come here? Is this the only place that's not burning down?
Avery batted her eyelashes at him.
Aren't you happy to see us?
He eyed her speculatively for a moment.
Always happy to see you.
Lissa was normally pretty straight-laced about this kind of thing, but something about it amused her. It was so wild, so silly. It was a break from all her recent worries.
It's not going to take them that long to figure it out, you know. They could be letting everyone in right now.
They could be, agreed Avery, putting her feet up on the coffee table.
But I have it on good authority that another alarm is going to go off in school once they open the doors.
How the hell did you manage that? Asked Christian.
Top secret.
Adrian rubbed his eyes and was clearly amused by this, despite the abrupt wake-up.
You can't pull fire alarms all day, Lazar.
Actually, I have it on good authority that once they give the all-clear on a second alarm, a third's going to go off.
Lissa laughed out loud, though a lot of it was due more to the guy's reactions and less to Avery's announcement. Christian, in fits of antisocial rebellion, had set people on fire. Adrian spent most of his days drunk and chain-smoking. For a cute society girl like Avery to astonish them, something truly remarkable had to happen. Avery looked very pleased at having outdone them.
If the interrogation's over now, she said, aren't you going to offer your guests any refreshments?
Adrian stood up and yawned.
Fine, fine, you insolent girl. I'll make coffee.
With a kick?
She inclined her head toward Adrian's liquor cabinet.
You've got to be kidding, said Christian. Do you even have a liver left?
Avery wandered over to the cabinet and picked up a bottle of something. She held it out to Lissa.
You game?
Even Lissa's morning rebelliousness had limits. The wine headache still throbbed in her skull.
Ugh, no. Cowards,
said Avery. She turned back to Adrian.
Well then, Mr. Ivashkov, you'd best put on the pot. I always like a little coffee with my brandy. Not long after that, I faded away from Lissa's head and drifted back into my own, returning to the blackness of sleep and ordinary dreams. It was short-lived, however, seeing as a loud pounding soon jerked me into consciousness. My eyes flew open, and a deep, searing pain shot through the back of my skull, the after effects of that toxic vodka, no doubt. Lissa's hangover had nothing on mine. I started to close my eyes, wanting to sink back under and let sleep heal the worst of my pain. Then, I heard the pounding again. And worse, my whole bed shook violently. Someone was kicking it. Opening my eyes again, I turned and found myself staring into Yeva's shrewd, dark eyes. If Sydney had met many Dompiers like Yeva, I can understand why she thought our race were minions of hell. Pursing her lips, Yeva kicked the bed again. "Hey!" I cried. "I'm awake, okay?" Yeva muttered something in Russian, and Paul peered around from behind her, translating.
"She says you're not awake until you're actually out of bed and standing up."
And with no more warning, that sadistic old woman continued kicking the bed. I jerked upright, and the world spun around me. I'd said this before, but this time, I really meant it. I was never going to drink again. No good ever came from it. The covers looked awfully tempting to my agonized body, but a few more kicks from Yeva's pointy-toed boots made me shoot up off the bed. "Okay, okay, are you happy now? I'm up." Yeva's expression didn't change, but at least she stopped with the kicking. I turned to Paul. "What's going on?"
"Grandmother says you have to go with her."
"Where?"
"She says you don't need to know."
I started to say that I wasn't following that crazy old wench anywhere, but after one look at her scary face, I thought better of it. I didn't put it past her to be able to turn people into toads. "Fine," I said. "I'll be ready to go once I shower and change." Paul translated my words, but Yeva shook her head and spoke again.
"She says there's no time," he explained. "We have to go now."
"Can I at least brush my teeth?" She allowed that small concession, but a change of clothes was apparently out of the question. It was just as well. Each step I took made me feel woozy, and I probably would have passed out doing something as complicated as dressing and undressing. The clothes didn't smell or anything either. They were mostly just wrinkled from where I'd fallen asleep in them. When I got downstairs, I saw that no one else was awake except Elena. She was washing leftover dishes from last night and seemed surprised to see me up. That made two of us.
"It's early for you, isn't it?"
she asked. I turned and caught sight of the kitchen clock. I gasped. It was only about 4 hours after I'd gone to bed. Good God, is the sun even up? Amazingly, it was. Elena offered to make me breakfast, but again, Yeva reiterated our time crunch. My stomach seemed to simultaneously want and loathe food, but I couldn't say if abstaining was a good thing or not. "Whatever," I said. "Let's just go and get this over with." Yeva walked into the living room and returned a few moments later with a large satchel. She handed it to me expectantly. I shrugged and took it, hanging it over one shoulder. It clearly had stuff in it, but it wasn't that heavy. She went back out to the other room and returned with another tote bag. I took this one too and hung it over the same shoulder, balancing both of them. This one was heavier, but my back didn't complain too much. When she left for a third time and returned with a giant box, I started to get irate. "What is this?" I demanded, taking it from her. It felt like it had bricks in it.
"Grandmother needs you to carry some things," Paul told me.
"Yes," I said through gritted teeth. "I sort of figured that out 50 pounds ago." Yeva gave me one more box, stacking it on top of the other. It wasn't as heavy, but by this point, it honestly didn't matter. Elena shot me a sympathetic look, shook her head, and returned silently to her dishes, apparently not about to argue with Yeva. Yeva set off after that, and I followed obediently, trying to both hold the boxes and not let the bags fall off my shoulder. It was a heavy load, one my hungover body really didn't want, but I was strong enough that I figured it wouldn't be a problem to get into town or wherever she was leading me. Paul ran along at my side, apparently there to let me know if Yeva found anything along the road she wanted me to carry, too.
It seemed like spring was charging into Siberia far faster than it ever did into Montana. The sky was clear, and the morning sun was heating things up surprisingly fast. It was hardly summer weather, but it was definitely enough to notice. It would have made very uncomfortable walking weather for a Maroi.
"Do you know where we're going?"
I asked Paul.
"No,"
he said cheerfully. For someone so old, Yeva could move at a pretty good pace, and I found myself having to hurry to keep up with her with my load. At one point, she glanced back and said something that Paul translated as,
"She's kind of surprised that you can't move faster."
"Yeah, well, I'm kind of surprised that no one else can carry any of this," he translated again.
"She says if you're really such a famous Dragoi killer, then this shouldn't be a problem."
I was filled with great relief when downtown came into sight. Only we kept walking past it.
"Oh, come on," I said. "Where the hell are we going?"
Without giving me a backward glance, Yeva rattled off something.
"Grandmother says Uncle Dimka never would have complained so much," Paul said.
None of this was Paul's fault. He was just the messenger. Yet every time he spoke, I kind of wanted to kick him. Nonetheless, I kept carrying my burden and didn't say anything else for the rest of the walk. Yeva was right to a certain extent. I was a Strigoi hunter, and it was true that Dimitri would have never complained about some old lady's crazy whims. He would have done his duty patiently. I tried to summon him up in my mind and draw strength from him. I thought about that time in the cabin again, thought about the way his lips had felt on mine, and the wonderful scent of his skin when I pressed closer to him. I could hear his voice once more, murmuring in my ear that he loved me, that I was beautiful, that I was the only one. Thinking of him didn't take away the discomfort of my journey with Yeva, but it made it a little more bearable. We walked for almost an hour more before reaching a small house, and I was ready to fall over in relief, soaked in sweat. The house was one floor, made of plain, weather-worn brown boards. The windows, however, were surrounded on three sides by exquisite, highly stylized blue shutters overlaid with a white design. It was the same sort of flashy use of color I'd seen on the buildings in Moscow and St. Petersburg. Yeva knocked on the door. At first there was only silence, and I panicked, thinking we'd have to turn right around and head back. Finally, a woman answered the door, a Maroi woman. She was maybe 30, very pretty, with high cheekbones and strawberry blonde hair. She exclaimed in surprise at seeing Yeva, smiling and greeting her in Russian. Glancing over at Paul and me, the woman quickly stepped aside and gestured us in. She switched to English as soon as she realized I was American. All these bilingual people were kind of amazing. It wasn't something I saw very often in the U.S. She pointed to a table and told me to set everything there, which I did with relief.
"My name's Oksana," she said, shaking my hand. "My husband, Mark, is in the garden and should be in soon."
"I'm Rose," I told her. Oksana offered us chairs. Mine was wooden and straight-backed, but at the moment, it felt like a down-filled bed. I sighed happily and wiped the sweat off my brow. Meanwhile, Oksana unpacked the things I'd carried. The bags were filled with leftovers from the funeral. The top box contained some dishes and pots, which Paul explained had been borrowed from Oksana some time ago. Oksana finally reached the bottom box, and so help me, it was filled with garden bricks.
"You have got to be kidding," I said.
Across the living room, Yeva looked very smug. Oksana was delighted by the gifts.
"Oh, Mark will be happy to have these," she smiled at me. "It was very sweet of you to carry these that whole way."
"Happy to help," I said stiffly.
The back door opened and a man walked in. Mark, presumably. He was tall and stockily built, his graying hair indicating an age greater than Oksana's. He washed his hands in the kitchen sink and then turned to join us. I nearly gasped when I saw his face and discovered something stranger than the age difference. He was a Dampier. For a moment, I wondered if this was someone else and not her husband, Mark. But that was the name Oksana introduced him with, and the truth hit me. A Maroi and Dampier married couple? Sure, our two races hooked up all the time. But marriage? It was very scandalous in the Maroi world. I tried to keep the surprise off my face and behave as politely as I could. Oksana and Mark seemed very interested in me, though she did most of the talking. Mark simply watched, curiosity all over his face. My hair was down, so my tattoos couldn't have given away my unpromised status. Maybe he was just wondering how an American girl had found her way out to the middle of nowhere. Maybe he thought I was a new blood whore recruit. By my third glass of water, I began to feel better. It was around that time that Oksana said we should eat, and by then, my stomach was ready for it. Oksana and Mark prepared the food together, dismissing any offers of help. Watching the couple work was fascinating. I had never seen such an efficient team. They never got in each other's way and never needed to talk about what needed doing next. They just knew. Despite the remote location, the kitchen's contents were modern, and Oksana placed a dish of some sort of potato casserole in the microwave. Mark's back was to her while he rummaged in the refrigerator, but as soon as she hit start, he said,
"No, it doesn't need to be that long."
I blinked in surprise, glancing back and forth between them. He hadn't even seen what time she'd selected. Then I got it. "You're bonded," I exclaimed. Both looked at me in equal surprise.
"Yes. Didn't Yeva tell you?"
Oksana asked. I shot a quick look at Yeva, who was again wearing that annoyingly self-satisfied look on her face. "No, Yeva hasn't been very forthcoming this morning."
"Most everyone around here knows,"
Oksana said, returning to her work.
Then you're a spirit user."
That made her pause again. She and Mark exchanged startled looks.
"That," she said, "is not something that's widely known."
"Most people think you haven't specialized, right?"
"How did you know?"
"Because it was exactly how it had been for Lissa and me. Stories of bonds had always existed in Maroi folklore, but how bonds formed had always been a mystery. It was generally believed they just happened. Like Oksana, Lissa had generally been regarded as a non-specializing Maroi, one who didn't have any special ability with one element. We realize now, of course, that bonding only occurred with spirit users, when they saved the lives of others." Something in Oksana's voice told me she wasn't really all that surprised I knew. I couldn't figure out how she'd realized that, however, and I was too stunned by my discovery to say anything else. Lissa and I had never ever met another bonded pair. The only such two we knew about were the legendary Vladimir and Anna, and those stories were shrouded by centuries of incomplete history, making it difficult to know fact from fiction. The only other leads we had to the world of spirit were Ms. Karp, a former teacher who went insane, and Adrian. Until now, he had been our biggest discovery, a spirit user who was more or less stable, depending on how you looked at it. When the meal was ready, spirit never came up. Oksana led the conversation, keeping to light topics and jumping between languages. I studied her and Mark as I ate, looking for any signs of instability. I saw none. They seemed like perfectly pleasant, perfectly ordinary people. If I hadn't known what I did, I would have had no reason to suspect anything. Oksana didn't seem depressed or unhinged. Mark hadn't inherited that vile darkness that sometimes seeped into me. My stomach welcomed the food, and the last of my headache faded away. At one point, though, a strange sensation swept through me. It was disorienting, like fluttering in my head, and a wave of heat and then ice coursing through me. The feeling disappeared as quickly as it came on, and I hoped it'd be the last of that demon vodka's ill effects. We finished eating, and I jumped up to help. Oksana shook her head.
"No, there's no need. You should go with Mark."
"Huh?" I asked. He dabbed at his face with a napkin and then stood up.
"Yes, let's go out to the garden."
I started to follow, then paused to glance back at Yeva. I expected her to chastise me for abandoning the dishes. Instead, I found no smug or disapproving looks. Her expression was knowing, almost expectant. Something about it sent a shiver down my back, and I recalled Victoria's words. Yeva had dreamed of my arrival. The garden Mark led me to was much bigger than I expected, enclosed in a thick fence and lined with trees. New leaves hung on them, blocking the worst of the heat. Lots of bushes and flowers were already in bloom, and here and there, young shoots were well on their way to adulthood. It was beautiful, and I wondered if Oksana had had a hand in it. Lissa was able to make plants grow with spirit. Mark gestured me over to a stone bench. We sat down side by side, and silence fell.
"So," he said,
What would you like to know?
Wow, you don't waste time.
I don't see any point in it. You must have lots of questions. I'll do my best to answer.
How did you know, I asked, that I'm Shadowkiss too? You did, right?
He nodded. Yeva told us.
Okay, that was a surprise.
Yeva? She can sense things. Things the rest of us can't. She doesn't always know what she's sensing, however. She only knew there was a strange feel to you, and she'd only ever felt that around one other person. So she brought you to me.
Seems like she could have done that without me having to carry a household's worth of stuff. This made him laugh.
Don't take it personally. She was testing you. She wanted to see if you're a worthy match for her grandson.
What's the point? He's dead now. I nearly choked on the words.
True, but for her, it's still important. And, by the way, she does think you're worthy.
She has a funny way of showing it. I mean, aside from bringing me to meet you, I guess. He laughed again.
Even without her, Oksana would have known what you are as soon as she met you. Being shadow-kissed has an effect on the aura.
So she can see auras, too, I murmured. What else can she do? She must be able to heal, or you wouldn't be shadow-kissed. Does she have super compulsion? Can she walk dreams? That caught him off guard.
Her compulsion is strong, yes. But what do you mean, walk dreams?
Like, she'd be able to enter someone else's mind when they're asleep. Anyone's mind, not just yours. Then they could have conversations just as if they were together. My friend can do it. Mark's expression told me that was new to him.
Your friend? Your bondmate?
Bondmate? I'd never heard that term. It was weird sounding, but it made sense. No, another spirit user.
Another? How many do you know?
3, technically. Well, 4 now, counting Oksana. Mark turned away, staring absent-mindedly at a cluster of pink flowers.
That many? That's incredible. I've only met one other spirit user, and that was years ago. He too was bonded to his guardian. That guardian died, and it ripped him apart. He still helped us when Oksana and I were trying to figure things out.
I braced myself for my own death all the time, and I feared for Lyssa's. Yet it had never occurred to me just what it would be like with a bond. How would it affect the other person? What would it be like to have a gaping hole where once you'd been intimately linked to someone else?
He never mentioned walking dreams either, Mark continued.
He chuckled again, friendly lines crinkling up around his blue eyes.
I thought I would be helping you, but maybe you're here to help me.
I don't know, I said doubtfully. I think you guys have more experience at this than we do.
Where's your bondmate?
Back in the U.S. I didn't have to elaborate, but somehow I needed to tell him the whole truth. I left her. He frowned.
Left as in you simply traveled, or left as in you abandoned her?
Abandoned. The word was like a slap in the face, and suddenly, all I could envision was that last day I'd seen her, when I'd left her crying. I had things to do, I said evasively.
Yes, I know, Oksana told me.
Told you what? Now he hesitated.
She shouldn't have done it. She tries not to.
Done what? I exclaimed, uneasy for reasons I couldn't explain.
She brushed your mind, during brunch.
I thought back and suddenly recalled the tickling in my head, the heat rolling over me. What does that mean, exactly?
An aura can tell a spirit user about someone's personality, but Oksana can also dig further, reaching in and actually reading more specific information about a person. Sometimes she can tie that ability into compulsion, But the results are very, very powerful. And wrong. It's not right to do that to someone you have no bond with.
It took me a moment to process that. Neither Lissa nor Adrian could read the thoughts of others. The closest Adrian could come to someone's mind was the dreamwalking. Lissa couldn't do that, not even for me. I could feel her, but the opposite wasn't true.
Oksana could feel... Oh, I don't know how to explain it. There's a recklessness in you. You're on some sort of quest. There's vengeance written all over your soul.
He suddenly reached over and lifted my hair up, peering at my neck.
Just as I thought, you're unpromised.
I jerked my head back. Why is that such a big deal? That whole town back there is filled with Dampiers who aren't guardians. I still thought Mark was a nice guy, but being preached to always irritated me.
Yes, but they've chosen to settle down. You and others like you. You become vigilantes of sorts. You're obsessed with hunting Strigoi on your own, with personally setting out to right the wrongs that whole race has brought down upon us. That can only lead to trouble. I see it all the time.
All the time? I asked, startled.
Why do you think guardian numbers are dwindling? They're leaving to have homes and families, or they're going off like you, still fighting but answering to no one, unless they're hired to be bodyguards or Strigoi hunters.
Dampiers for hire? I suddenly began to understand how a non-royal like Abe had gotten his bodyguards. Money could make anything happen, I suppose. I've never heard of anything like that.
Of course not. You think the Moroi and other guardians want that widely known? Want to dangle that in front of you as an option?
I don't see what's so wrong with Strigoi hunting. We're always defensive, not offensive, when it comes to Strigoi. Maybe if more Dampiers set out after them, they wouldn't be such a problem.
Perhaps, but there are different ways of going about that. Some better than others. And when you're going out like you are, with a heart filled with sorrow and revenge, that's not one of the better ways. It'll make you sloppy. And the Shadow Kiss darkness will just complicate things.
I crossed my arms over my chest and stared stonily ahead. Yeah, well, it's not like I can do much about that. He turned to me, expression surprised once more.
Why don't you just have your bondmate heal the darkness out of you?
Chapter 11. I stared at Mark for several long seconds. Finally, stupidly, I asked, Did you say heal? Mark stared at me in equal surprise.
Yes, of course. She can heal other things, right? Why not this?
Because, I frowned, that doesn't make any sense. The darkness? All the bad side effects? Those come from Lissa. If she could just heal it, why wouldn't she heal it out of herself?
Because when it's in her, it's too ingrained, too tied into her being. She can't heal it the way she can other things. But once your bond has pulled it into you, it's like any other sickness.
My heart was pounding in my chest. What he was suggesting was too ridiculously easy. No, it was just ridiculous, period. There was no way after all that we'd been through that Lissa could heal that rage and depression the way she could a cold or a broken leg. Victor Dazhkov, despite his wicked schemes, had known an astonishing amount about spirit and had explained it to us. The other four elements were more physical in nature, but spirit came from the mind and soul. To use that mental energy, to be able to do such powerful things, couldn't be done without devastating side effects. We'd been fighting those side effects from the beginning, first in Lissa and then in me. They couldn't just go away. If that were possible, I said quietly, then everyone would have done it. Ms. Karp wouldn't have lost her mind. Anna wouldn't have committed suicide. What you're saying is too easy. Mark didn't know who I was talking about, but clearly it didn't matter for what he wanted to express.
You're right. It's not easy at all. It requires a careful balance, a circle of trust and strength between two people. It took Oksana and me a long time to learn. Many hard years.
His face darkened, and I could only imagine what those years had been like. My short time with Lissa had been bad enough. They'd